Lazarus. He was a pathetic figure. He's destitute, hungry, full of sores. If one's life circumstances reflected one's spiritual destiny, Lazarus would seem about as far from the kingdom of heaven as one could get. But the meaning of his name is instructive here. What does this man's name mean? The only named character in the parables of Jesus.
That's the Reverend Scott Jones, and today he shares a powerful message of faith entitled, Live and Let Die. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now, to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're pleased to have with us the Reverend Scott Kent Jones, popular podcaster and ordained minister. Scott produces and hosts Give and Take, in which he talks with artists, authors, theologians, and political pundits, including Miroslav Volf, Nadia Bolz-Weber, A.J. Jacobs, Rob Bell, and Krista Tippett. He's the former host and producer of the Mockingcast podcast and an in-demand consultant on all things pod. He also co-hosts with Bill Bohrer, the new Persuasive Words podcast. Scott is also a prolific writer, frequent conference speaker, and PhD candidate in theology. He and his wife, Lindy, live in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Scott, welcome to Day One.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
Someone once observed that if Howard Stern and Krista Tippett had a love child, it would be Scott Jones. So how did your interest in interviewing and podcasting come around?
Well, it was interesting. I had a friend who's a pastor. His name's Bill Bohrer, and we actually decided to do a podcast together. It's called New Persuasive Words, and I think we're getting close to episode 300. But
wow.
We just were friends talking about life with what we hoped was some wit and wisdom, at least on our good days. And I was just, I loved it. I've always loved radio, and I had a knack for the tech stuff, and I loved the art form. And eventually, I got hired to do a podcast for an organization called Mockingbird. And I developed this podcast called The Mockingcast, which was part sort of roundtable discussion on the week's events and part interviews. And I never thought I would love interviewing as much as I do, you know, and it became a real passion. And now the podcast I do that probably gets the most listens is a long form interview show called Give and Take, right? Just interview all sorts of authors, thinkers, activists, artists, sort of whoever comes across my radar that I find interesting. And now it's interesting. One of the nice things is I don't have to buy a lot of books because I get them sent to me like every day.
Mm-hmm. So you combine empathy, humor, and a knowledge of religion, current events, and pop culture. So how did theology and faith come into it all for you?
Yeah, I grew up in New Jersey, and we were members of a Methodist church, but we didn't really go much. I remember a lot of Sunday morning cartoons and stuff like that. And I had these two friends who were in middle school. I was in elementary school. They were like 2 years older than me. And one of them was named Tommy Bachman. And I remember, I mean, Tommy knew algebra. He could throw a curveball. I wanted to be Tommy Bachman, right? And I remember Tommy telling me I needed to accept Jesus as my personal Lord and Savior. And he quoted the book of Revelation. And it was a little dark and heavy for a kid. But if Tommy was in, I was in. So I remember running home three doors down. And I walk into the living room and, you know, an 11-year-old boy or whatever, your mom goes, what are you doing? What are you up to? And I said, did you know that if you accept Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior, you go to heaven when you die? And my mom said, well, yes. I said, why didn't you tell me? And I ran upstairs and locked my door. And Tommy said it had to be personal. So I didn't know if this was personal enough. So I got in my closet and I prayed like Tommy told me to pray. And I had a mystical experience. And I'm not given to those very often. Mm-hmm. And from there, it became a lifelong journey of faith where Jesus became the animating principle of my life. And really, it's been an incredible journey from that closet.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're currently producing at least two podcasts, and you mentioned your own Give and Take, which features in-depth conversations with some very interesting people. What do you try to accomplish in your interviews?
Yeah, I think that there's a lost art of conversation mm-hmm. in our culture between sound bites and call out culture and cable news, that there's a lack of real human understanding. And so I like to give someone a chance to converse about what they're passionate about and hopefully find where their work and their life story kind of connects. Mm-hmm. And I think that something about when that human connection happens about something that's significant, you know, around something that's significant where human passions connect, where there's understanding, I feel like that's a magical kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that really, I mean, it's so rewarding to me when the publicist, you know, will email me after, this person felt so understood. They said this was the most fun interview. What's shocking to me is they always are shocked that I've read their book, which is, I'm like, or, you know, I know their work, which I'm like, well, why would I have you on if I wasn't going to engage your work? But I think that, like, taking someone seriously and having fun with that and really talking in an open-ended way is something that, like, we need more of in our culture. Mm.
And though radio isn't going anywhere, podcasting is booming. How do you suggest listeners find podcasts that are relevant to them?
In general, I think a lot of stuff is word of mouth. Hmm. You know, I mean, algorithms are good. And I found some podcasts through, you know, the podcast app or Overcast, and there are recommendations that algorithms make. But oftentimes, the podcasts I'm listening to are podcasts I found through my own friends and interlocutors and what they're listening to. So in general, I find that that's how my sort of, you know, listening cue develops. It's what, you know, it's what people are talking about or what I'm curious about or that sort of thing. And what's great also with searching, you know, you find a person. It's funny, there's a guy who's become a devoted sort of listener of Give and Take. Mm-hmm. And it was simply because one of the scholars I interviewed, Douglas Campbell at Duke, Googled that guy's name or something, and my podcast came up, and then he's like, wow, this is great. So, I mean, sometimes if you just are interested in a person or a topic or something, if you just search it, you'll find podcasts that have talked about it. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of it is kind of a hit and hope sort of thing. You know, it's like Googling. I mean, there's no sort of exact science to it.
I do have to add that our Day One program is also available as a podcast on a bunch of apps and that it includes longer interviews. And we've been doing it since iTunes was launched way back in 2001. But what do you think the future holds for communicating faith in this way through podcasting?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think a couple things. I think that very often what it gives space for is people that feel a little tribalist. Hmm. That maybe they don't quite fit in one of the dominant cultural or church tribes or something, and they find a voice that makes sense to them, and they're not bound then locally, you know, or by geography. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's so interesting about it. I've heard several people who are sort of in the podcasting world and movement say, don't think of your audience as an audience. Think of them as a community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really true, that this becomes a sort of community for people very often where, you know, people feel connected because they find like-minded, you know, fellow travelers. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me is an interesting kind of thing about the medium. And people like who are burnt out by traditional forms of religious institutions and things and yet are still spiritual, mm-hmm. find people like Rob Bell and people mm-hmm. like that, you know, and find, you know, streams of living water outside traditional institutions. And I think that that's really part of what it is. And also it has a possibility of strengthening traditional institutions where you can reach people who maybe wouldn't be connected, you know, wouldn't darken the door of your church or something. And yet you're having conversations that they might want to hear. And if you can figure out a way to connect them to those, that maybe you'll connect to new people in a different sort of digital outreach. Mm.
So, Scott, you also serve as a supply pastor in a Reformed Church in America congregation.
Yeah.
So how do you approach preaching in real time?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I never have a manuscript. I have notes on my iPad or something. And one of the nicest things that people continually say to me, and it's incredibly moving, it's humbling, they always say that I feel like you're preaching right to me on Sundays. Mm-hmm. And really, I'm just preaching to myself, right? Like, I'm not, like, I think about my own neuroses, my own insecurities, my own anxieties, my own demons. And I think that the deeper you get into your own story, the more universal you are. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we all have like one human story, right? That's the eat, pray, love thing, right? This woman is a counselor and she goes to help these boat people who've been in this trauma. And she thinks it's going to be about all this traumatic experience. And really they're talking about, well, I'm in love with this guy and I was betrayed here. I mean, there's only so many threads in the human story. And so I try to take the scriptures and where the gospel is in them and try to sort of think about how it applies to that human story, which usually I'm the laboratory for it. So I'm thinking, where does this get under my skin? And I try to mine that really deep, and that tends to be where people are thinking that I'm talking to them. I'm really just talking to myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, your sermon draws from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 16. Would you read it for us?
Jesus said, "There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was being tormented, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. He called out, 'Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony in these flames.' But Abraham said, 'Child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner evil things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. Besides all this, between you and us a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so, and no one can cross from there to us.' He said, 'Then, Father, I beg you to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may warn them, so that they will not also come into this place of torment.' Abraham replied, 'They have Moses and the prophets. They should listen to them.' He said, 'No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent.' He said to him, 'If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead.'"
So Jesus tells this amazing story, and it seems kind of a bit over the top. But what struck you as you read this passage?
There's a couple things about this passage I find fascinating, right? I think one of the stereotypical pictures of the traditional doctrine of damnation or something is that there's sort of this boiling pot of oil and hands are trying to get out and God's sort of sitting on it, you know? Mm-hmm. And now it seems like what got the rich man in the place of perdition keeps him there. Mm-hmm. You know, he sort of chose it himself and continues to choose it himself. You know, he can't get rid of the idols that got him there. You know, you think of the great divorce with C.S. Lewis, mm-hmm. where they take bus trips up to heaven and nobody wants to stay there, you know? So that I think is interesting. And also it does strike me that Lazarus is the only one named, you know, the only character named in any of the parables. And I think that oftentimes we lose this thread of death and resurrection. That's not just the Passion Week, but it's the thread of Jesus' ministry. It's a thread of a lot of his teachings. Mm-hmm. And you know, if this whole idea that if when you die to yourself, right, when you let go and let go of control, you can live. And yet when you attempt to save your life, it slips through your fingers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why people like Brené Brown are so popular today, right? Because mm-hmm. it's the secular version of this deep gospel truth that I think resonates. And I think this story is one of those just where it just resonates so deeply, where the story of death and resurrection, where the loser winds up winning by no ingenuity of his own.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, your message is entitled Live and Let Die. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure. I came across a column that David Brooks wrote earlier this year. It went viral, and in the opening paragraph, he explains his reason for writing it. He says, 4 years ago, in the midst of the Obama presidency, I published a book called The Road to Character. American culture seemed to be in decent shape, and my focus was on how individuals can deepen their inner lives. This week, in the midst of the Trump presidency, I've got another book, The Second Mountain. It's become clear in the interim that things are not in good shape, that our problems are societal. The whole country is going through some sort of spiritual and emotional crisis. College mental health facilities are swamped. Suicide rates are spiking. The president's repulsive behavior is tolerated or even celebrated by tens of millions of Americans. At the root of it all is the following problem. We've created a culture based on lies. In the piece, Brooks identifies the five biggest lies our culture tells, the ones he sees at the heart of our culture's shared spiritual sickness. He lists them. 1, career success is fulfilling. 2, I can make myself happy. 3, life is an individual journey. 4, you have to find your own truth. And 5, rich and successful people are worth more than poorer and less successful people. His brief exposition of the fifth lie is penetrating and really identifies a central thread that runs through all of the aforementioned ones. It's worth quoting him at length here. We pretend we don't tell this lie, the fifth one, but our whole meritocracy points to it. In fact, the meritocracy contains a skein of lies. The message of the meritocracy is that you are what you accomplish. The false promise of the meritocracy is that you can earn dignity by attaching yourself to prestigious brands. The emotion of the meritocracy is conditional love, that if you perform well, people will love you. The sociology of the meritocracy is that society is organized around a set of inner rings with the high achievers inside and everyone else further out. The anthropology of the meritocracy is that you are not a soul to be saved, but a set of skills to be maximized. No wonder it's so hard to be a young adult today. No wonder our society is fragmenting. We've taken the lies of hyper-individualism and we've made them the unspoken assumptions that govern how we live. I once heard a prominent evangelical preacher say that when sophisticates in the metropolitan area where he preaches ask him if he believes in a hell with literal fire and brimstone, he says, of course not. They're usually shocked because he's got a reputation as a conservative evangelical. He says, of course not. He thinks all that fire and brimstone talk is just a metaphor for something far worse. The hit 80s sitcom Cheers had one of the catchiest theme songs in television history. The lyrics describe what most of us are looking for most of the time, if we're honest. Making your way in the world today takes everything you got. Taking a break from all your worries, it sure would help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name. And they're always glad you came. You want to be where you can see the troubles are all the same. You want to be where everybody knows your name. You want to go where people know the people are all the same. You want to go where everybody knows your name. We all want to go where somebody knows our name. We want to have a name, and we want to be known by it. The mistake comes when we think we can make a name for ourselves, one worth knowing that will lead us to being known. The parable in Luke 16 is the only one where a character is actually named. It's the only parable where Jesus names a character. Lazarus. Lazarus is someone that lost the meritocratic race. He was a pathetic figure. He's destitute, hungry, full of sores. If one's life circumstances reflected one's spiritual destiny, Lazarus would seem about as far from the kingdom of heaven as one could get. But the meaning of his name is instructive here. What does this man's name mean? The only named character in the parables of Jesus. God is my help. That's what his name means. His situation put him in a place where a name could only be received, not achieved. He had nothing to make a name for himself, nothing to brag about, nothing which he could hold out that would give him a name worth knowing. And what a name it is. Contrast this to the rich man in the parable who remains unnamed. He's more reminiscent of those wandering east of Eden that we find in Genesis 11:4, when they say, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." These two men's paths seem to have crossed regularly in their lives, although the rich man probably went out of his way to avoid the likes of Lazarus. They both die and find themselves separated by an unbridgeable chasm in the afterlife. Lazarus is in Abraham's bosom, while the rich man is in a place of torment. What's interesting is that it's exactly the things that put the rich man in the place of torment that keep him there. He still thinks he's someone of import and significance. He thinks he's in a place to call shots and to give orders. He still thinks himself to be above Lazarus. He makes requests from a sense of entitlement, but not once does he really ask for mercy and accept that the name he made for himself actually made him nameless. He's just some rich guy. He can't bear to make God his help, and thus he remains just some rich guy trapped in the mess that his relentless pursuit of the good life got him into. Death and resurrection isn't just the story of the Passion Week. It's a through line in so many of the parables and teachings of Jesus. This one is no exception. Lazarus looks like one of life's losers, while the rich man looks like one of life's winners. And yet, beyond the veil, Lazarus seems to have won. But how? By simply accepting that he's dead. That's the only way to resurrection. The rich man can't accept that he's dead. He bargains and attempts to wriggle his way out of the situation with reckless abandon. His inability to accept death precludes him from a possible resurrection life. Only the dead get resurrected. In some ways, this parable anticipates the parable of the Pharisee and the publican. There, Jesus tells a story of two men who are dead in their sins. The publican acknowledges and accepts his deadness and is justified, while the Pharisee denies and rejects his condition and is condemned. Ultimately, we will either receive the name Lazarus by accepting our deadness and trusting the God who raises the dead to be our help, or we will attempt to make a name for ourselves and remain nameless and immune to being raised up to new life. I heard a story a couple of years ago about a pastor in Chicago. He's a friend of a friend. It's an actual story. He had a nice family, including his oldest son who had just graduated high school, who he loved very much. After his son graduated high school, he started to distance himself from his family and plunged headlong into the drug culture in Chicago. Over a year goes by. They don't hear from him. They don't hear from him in over 18 months. And then one Saturday night at 2 a.m., actually, more like Sunday morning, they get a call, and it's the police. "We have your son. He's had a DUI. You have to come pick him up." The pastor gets out of bed, goes down to the precinct, and explains who he is and that he's here for his son. They look at him perplexed. They have no idea what he's talking about. Now, okay, it's Chicago. I'm sure there's a lot of precincts, so he goes to the next precinct. Same thing. They have no idea what he's talking about. He goes to two more precincts. All of a sudden, it's 4 a.m. Church is in a few hours. He's not going to go back to sleep. So he decides to go to the last place he remembers his son living, which was in a derelict part of town. It was a crack house. He goes in and people are sleeping all over the place. He looks around and he locates his son sleeping on a mattress in a back room. At 5 a.m. in this hellhole, his heart breaks. He falls to his knees, then he kisses his son, and then he gets up and leaves. About 4 months later, the son shows up at the house. Then he shows up again 3 weeks later, then again 2 weeks later. Soon, he's there all the time. Slowly, he's integrated back into the life of the family. His father asked him one day, "What the heck happened? What transpired that took you out of the life you were in?" The son said, "Dad, don't you know? It was that night. You know, the night you got the call? It was one of my friends playing a prank on you. We all laughed, thinking about how you, getting ready for church, would have to spend your night in precincts looking for me, imagining the look on your face when you got to the officers' desks. But the one thing we never imagined is that you'd come to the house where I lived. Dad, we saw you coming down the street and we all dove for the beds. I wasn't asleep that night. When you walked into my room and found me, I knew you'd be so furious at me. I was readying myself for you to kick me as hard as you could. You want to know what changed me? You didn't kick me. You kissed me. You kissed me. And that changed everything. The kiss of God, that's what saves us. And to receive it, we need do nothing but acknowledge our deadness and receive it. When we attempt to make a name rather than receive it, God's presence feels like it's kicking us. But when we take the name Lazarus and God is our help, the kiss of God raises the dead.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Scott Kent Jones, a minister based in the Philadelphia area, host of Give and Take podcast, and co-host of the new Persuasive Words podcast. For a free printed transcript of his message, Live and Let Die, call us at 404-815-9110. That's 404-815-9110. Or email us at info@dayone.org. That's info@day1.org. Or write to us at Day 1, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. Day 1 is made possible by the generous contributions of listeners like you. If you appreciate what you hear, consider sending a donation. We're grateful for your much-needed support. I'm Sherry Miller. Next week on Day 1, we're honored to have with us the Reverend Christopher Henry, Senior Pastor of Second Presbyterian Church in Indianapolis, Indiana. You won't want to miss his powerful message, A Joyful Obligation, next time on Day 1. Now, Scott Jones offers some final reflections on today's message with our host, Peter Wallace.
Scott, you cited David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, who had a recent change of mind about our culture. He believes now that the whole country is going through some sort of spiritual and emotional crisis, and it's because we've created a culture built on lies. And Brooks set out five biggest lies, including number five. Rich and successful people are worth more than poorer and less successful people. Why do you think that lie seems to be the default position of our society?
I think where he really hits the nail on the head is the meritocracy myth, mm-hmm. right? That we have the myth of the self-made person, that everybody can achieve, you know, if they set their mind to it, which I think, you know, it's so interesting. You think about just how much luck is involved in anything. Let's say you're this brilliant hedge fund manager, right? Well, you have a kind of intelligence that if you'd been born in the prehistoric hunter-gatherer society, you probably would have been like left out because, you know, you like even the hard work that somebody does is, you know, they're in the right place. They're in the right context, you know, to exploit, you know, the gifts of circumstance. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's so hard to accept, right? Because we want to think great about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so once you go down that road, you can't but think that you're worth more, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's just, I mean, you can say that you don't subscribe to it, but it's just the gravitational pull is so deep to think that way. And I and again, when he says it, we all want to say, oh, no, we don't believe that. And yet you think, maybe I kind of do, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Of course, Jesus has something relevant to say, which he does here in Luke 16 with the story of the rich man who's unnamed and Lazarus, the poor man whose name means God is my help. And even though Lazarus is resting in Abraham's bosom and the rich man is in a place of torment, he still considers himself entitled to call the shots and give orders. And ultimately, you said, we will either receive the name Lazarus by accepting our deadness and trusting the God who raises the dead to be our help, or we will attempt to make a name for ourselves and remain nameless and immune to being raised up to new life. The choice seems so simple, so why is it so hard to break through?
Yeah, I think because we are addicted to self-salvation and self-justification projects. My friend David Zoll just had the book come out called Seculosity, where he looks at how we're not less religious. We've just chosen secular religion, right? So people are as religious about parenting or eating or CrossFit or politics as they traditionally were about religion. But oftentimes it's the worst form of religion. It's the Pharisee, not the publican. It's the kind of thing where we want to feel like we did something ourselves, right? And so the hardest thing about the gospel is that we bring nothing to the table, which is humiliating. I mean, Robin Williams once talked about the humiliation that leads to humility. And so we oftentimes, especially in churches, and there's a right-wing form of it and a left-wing form of it, where the gospel is presented not as resurrection from the dead and a gift that you can only receive, but it's presented as a way to transform your life and society. So there's a right-wing form and a left-wing form. But what it does is really say to people that with your anxieties and your struggles, if you just do these things, if you read your Bible enough and don't drink, smoke, or chew, or go with girls that do, or if you go out and help establish the beloved community and are a good activist, that you'll be saved. And it's just another form of moving the goalposts, right? But the hard thing is that it's like the Indigo Girls song. The hardest to learn is the least complicated. It's not complicated. It's just really hard to accept that there's nothing you can do but be accepted. It feels like a fraud, right? Like this is just, it's like when they came up with like the Bisquick, the cake mix, and people didn't like it, would just add water. And they figured out, wait, if you just tell them to add an egg and a little milk, then, oh, it works if I can do that, right? It's too easy if I just add water. I think that the message of Jesus, it seems too simple, right? So people feel like, well, if I could just add some eggs and milk, then I could believe in it.
You shared a beautiful story about a father searching for his damaged son, finding him in squalor and kissing him when he thought his son was asleep, and it changed the son's life. And you spoke of the kiss of God. How might that kiss of God happen in our lives?
Yeah, I think it generally comes when we are at the end of our rope, right? Usually it comes when we are struggling, when the sort of self-justifications and the lies we live by, the covers start to not cover our feet anymore, right? We're kind of cold in our existential night. You know, I think that oftentimes it's when we are in the process of losing our life somehow, right? The thing which we thought gave us significance begins to falter. And then it's often where we can actually be opened up to the gentleness and tenderness of God.
Scott, what's one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind in the days ahead?
Hey, God can be your help, and he wants to be.
Scott Jones, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Day One is the voice of America's historic mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for listening. I'm Sherry Miller wishing you all God's blessings on day one and forever.